down that way. He pointed south. They'll have a walk on the beach, and the truck will pick them up somewhere down that way. He pointed north. Unless they climb a telephone pole and tap into the line, which I don't think is likely, they're going to have to go someplace in the truck to get on the telephone. Even if they seen the boat, four of them aren't going to do anything. They'd want more people, and they sure as hell are under orders to report something like this.
Yes, Weston agreed, feeling grossly incompetent.
So the question is, do we want to take them out in case they seen the boat or in case they come back? If they do, they damn sure will see the boat, or are we going to hope we're lucky?
I think we had better take them out, Weston agreed, with what he hoped was far more assurance than he felt.
That means you'll have to take them out by yourself, Everly said.
Your goddamn ankle, Weston said.
I didn't do it on purpose, Mr. Weston, Everly said. And one of us is going to have to stay here anyway. If those guys in the boat hear shooting, we don't want them paddling back to the sub.
Shit.
Can I make a suggestion?
Of course.
You go after the Japs. If you stick close to the jungle and don't make too much noise, you ought to be able to catch up to them without them suspecting anything. It's going to take those guys in the boat 5 minutes to make sure. That'll give you enough time to catch up with the Japs, unless they decide to turn around. When the boat makes shore, I'll fire a shot, then you take out the Japs. They're all bunched up, you should be able to do it easy, and then we'll take it from there.
God damn it. Why did they have to patrol this lousy section of beach right now?
Things happen that way, Mr. Weston, Everly said.
How long ago did the Japs go by?
You really didn't see them?
Everly asked wonderingly, and then answered the question.
About 2 minutes ago. They was walking slow. Your ass starts to drag in a hurry walking through sand.
I'll take them out when I hear your shot, Weston said. You make sure whoever's in that rubber boat doesn't leave.
Aye, aye, sir.
They rose to their feet and left the protective cover of the jungle. Weston started trotting up the beach, keeping as close to the vegetation as he could. Within a minute, he realized that Everly was right again. Walking through sand, not to mention trying to run through it, does in fact cause the ass to start dragging in a hurry. In 3 minutes, the Japanese came into sight. None of them seemed at all attentive to anything. Weston began to close the distance between himself and them, taking as much solace as he could from the knowledge that his was not the only dragging ass. When he came out of the jungle, Everly had concealed himself, flat on his stomach, behind a massive outcrop of rock. Suddenly, he got to his feet. The two men were no longer in the boat. After a moment, Everly spotted their heads in the water, and then they began to rise higher and higher from the water, dragging the boat behind them. Finally, they were on the beach. They were dressed in what looked like utilities dyed black, and they had some kind of black grease rubbed on their faces. Even so, one of them looked familiar. Everly stepped from behind the rock.
McCoy, is that you?
He called.
Who's that?
Everly.
Give us a hand with the boat, McCoy ordered. Everly walked quickly to the edge of the water. Up close, the man with McCoy looked 17 years old.
We got a problem, Everly announced.
What kind of a problem?
Four Japs, about 500 yards down the beach, Everly said.
Then he raised his Thompson to his shoulder, raised the muzzle into the air, and pulled the trigger. Two shots rang out. Weston had been waiting for the signal. The four Japanese soldiers were walking slowly in a file not more than 20 yards in front of him. Weston was really surprised that they didn't seem to have any idea that they were being shadowed. He was carrying the Thompson, with growing difficulty, he was running out of breath, much like a quail hunter carries his shotgun when he expects a covey to flush. He was prepared to fire instantly. He was aware of the analogy and the differences. Quail hunters do not usually run through sand. No shotgun he had ever held was nearly as heavy as the Thompson, and quail flush. They do not turn and shoot back. He had the Thompson to his shoulder and had drawn a sight on the lead Japanese before the first Japanese, hearing the shots, turned in the action of unslinging his Arisaka rifle from his shoulder. Time seemed to move very slowly. The first Jap bent his knees and dropped in his tracks. The second and third Japanese in the file fell over forward. The last Japanese, in the act of shouldering his Arasaka, took a four-round burst in the chest and fell over backward. Weston ran forward to them, the Thompson still at his shoulder. The first and third Japanese showed signs of life. Without really thinking what he was doing, Weston took his Nambu pistol, already carrying around in the chamber, and shot both of them in the head. A little sanity returned. He felt a twinge of nausea at the sight of the blood and brain matter on the sand. And then, in a reflex action, Weston stripped each of the bodies of their ammunition, gathered up the Arasakas, and, staggering under the weight, started back to where he had left Everly. "What the hell?" McCoy asked, just before they heard the four bursts, three short and one long burst, from Weston's Thompson.
"Captain Weston was waiting for my signal before taking them out," Everly said.
McCoy turned to the kid. "Koffler, go see if you can help down there," he ordered.
"Aye, aye, sir,"
Koffler responded, pulling a Colt 45 pistol from under his dyed black utilities and started to run down the beach.
"He little young, isn't he, McCoy?"
Everly asked as he and McCoy dragged the rubber boat across the narrow beach and into the jungle. McCoy didn't reply. "Is it safe enough to bring in a couple more boats?" he asked.
"Your call, McCoy," Everly replied. "I think that was all the Japs for right now, but I don't know that."
McCoy took a black bag of some kind from the boat, then took a knife, a dagger-like weapon, from a sheath strapped to his arm, and sliced at the bag.
"Jesus Christ, I'll be a monkey's uncle if that isn't the same knife he used to cut those Italian Marines,"
Everly thought in wonder. Then McCoy had a microphone in his hand and was pulling what looked like an automobile antenna out of a black box. "Coffin, Coffin, Columbus, Columbus."
"Go ahead, Columbus. Read you 5x5.
"Coffin, send in two, repeat, two boats."
"Understand, two boats, on the way."
"Who the hell are you talking to, killer?"
Everly asked. McCoy didn't reply directly. "I guess they didn't hear that Thompson," he said. "Otherwise, I probably would have been talking to nobody." Then he touched Everly's arm, and when Everly looked at him, nodded out to sea. The conning tower of the Sunfish rose from the sea. Before her deck broke water, there was activity on her bridge. Two officers appeared, identifiable by their brimmed caps, and then four or five sailors. A 50-caliber machine gun appeared and was quickly put in its mount. There was the glint of gleaming belted cartridges as the gun was charged. The national colors sprouted on a mast, their red, white, and blue suddenly vivid in the early morning sun against the wet gray of the Sunfish. The officers and sailors in the conning tower saluted as the wind whipped the flag straight. A port in the conning tower burst open and sailors poured out, some to man the 4-inch cannon mounted forward, some rushing to open ports in her deck. Two rubber boats suddenly inflated on the Sunfish's deck and were quickly put over the side.
"Shit," Everly said, his voice breaking. "Look at that fucking flag, will you?"
Weston and Koffler came running back down the beach while the two rubber boats making their way to shore were still 100 yards offshore.
"Got them all," Weston reported excitedly, even jubilantly. "We dragged the bodies off the beach."
"Mr. Weston, this is Killer McCoy," Everly said.
"Fuck you, Everly," McCoy snapped.
"McCoy, this is Captain Weston," Everly said.
McCoy, smiling, saluted.
"Lieutenant McCoy, sir," he said.
"Captain, you need a shave."
"I'm Sergeant Koffler, sir," Koffler said to Captain Weston. "We didn't have time for introductions back there."
"How do you do, Sergeant?" Weston replied formally.
"You're a sergeant?" Everly asked incredulously.
"He's a staff sergeant," McCoy said, chuckling. "Zimmerman, he's in one of those boats, is a gunny."
Weston looked out to sea and saw the rubber boats and then the Sunfish with her colors streaming proudly from her mast, and then he realized that tears were streaming down his cheeks, and his chest was heaving with sobs he couldn't control.
3.
"Do you have any people with you, Captain?" McCoy asked.
"No, it's just Lieutenant Everly and myself," Weston said.
"Lieutenant Everly?" McCoy asked.
"The general commissioned me, McCoy," Everly said.
"What were you before the war, Captain?" McCoy asked. I was a lieutenant. I'm an aviator, Weston said. Hearing what he said, he realized that he no longer felt like an aviator. It seemed impossible that he had ever done anything like that.
You're a Marine officer? A regular?
Yes, I am.
Are there any other officers around? McCoy asked. Somebody with more rank?
Captain Hedges, Everly said. He's leading a patrol here.
When will he get here?
2-3 days.
He has to come 60 miles. Maybe 4, Everly said.
Nobody higher than a captain?
That's it, McCoy, Everly said.
Can you paddle a rubber boat, Captain? McCoy asked. I mean, if we can get you into a rubber boat, could you paddle it out to the submarine?
I think so.
How much do you know about Fertig's operation?
Here you go, Mr. McCoy, Koffler said, handing him a carbine. Careful, it's loaded and not locked.
What the hell is that thing?
Everly asked derisively. And then,
he called you Mr. McCoy?
You can call me Sir Percy, McCoy said. It's a carbine. Fires a real hot 30-caliber pistol cartridge from a 15-round magazine. Good little weapon. We're going to try to bring 100 of them ashore.
You know, I don't like being called Percy, Everly said.
Then don't call me Killer, or I will make you call me Sir Percy.
Mr. McCoy is a lieutenant, Koffler furnished helpfully.
You're in charge here, Mr. McCoy? Weston asked.
I am, McCoy said simply. I asked you, how much do you know about Fertig's operation?
I'm the G2, Weston said.
That OSS guy is in the first boat, Mr. McCoy, Koffler said. Him and Mr. Lewis.
McCoy turned to look at him. He was peering out to sea through binoculars.
Give me those, he ordered.
Koffler somewhat reluctantly handed them over.
Police up that plastic, McCoy ordered. Jesus Christ, Steve, you know better than to leave stuff like that for the Japs to find.
Sorry, Koffler said contritely, and immediately dropped to his knees to pick up the shredded plastic in which the radio, the binoculars, and the carbines had been wrapped.
What I want you to do, Captain, McCoy said, is go out in the surf until you're up to your waist. Koffler will go with you. Leave the Thompson. When that first boat gets here, help unload it. The stuff will float and Koffler will see it doesn't get away. Then get in and go out to the submarine.
What for? Weston asked.
My orders are to send the highest-ranking officer I can find out with the Sunfish. You're it.
Why? I'm not sure.
Don't argue with me, McCoy said coldly. Just do it.
You better do it, Mr. Weston, Everly said.
Weston looked at McCoy, confusion in his eyes. McCoy felt sorry for him.
I think you're going to brief General MacArthur on what's going on around here, he said with a smile.
I know you're going to brief General Pickering.
MacArthur?
Everly said.
No shit?
No shit, Everly, McCoy said. And, Captain, don't shave off that beard until General Pickering sees it.
Weston still looked confused and hesitant.
Go, goddammit, McCoy said. By the time you wade through the surf, the boat will be there.
Weston looked at Everly, who nodded.
Have a cold one for me, Mr. Weston, he said, and put out his hand.
Take care of yourself, Everly, Weston said, aware and surprised that he wanted to cry again.
Yeah,
Everly said. He held out his hand for Weston's Thompson submachine gun. Weston gave it to him, then walked to the edge of the water and waded in.
Where can we stash the stuff we're bringing ashore? McCoy asked, turning to Everly.
How much stuff?
What's in those two boats for now? McCoy said. More stuff tomorrow if we get away with this.
I think you can forget tomorrow, Everly said. There's going to be Japs over here sooner or later, and I think sooner.
Tell me about the Japs, McCoy said.
4-man patrol, Everly responded. I think they got off a truck down there a ways and were supposed to be picked up by another a couple of miles down that. When they don't show up, I think somebody will come looking for them.
How much time?
Everly threw up his hands helplessly.
If we're lucky, nobody heard the Thompson. That may give us a little more time. If they did, we could have Japs any time.
What about stashing this stuff?
There's jungle for maybe half a mile from here to the road in a straight line. Any place between here and a road would be as good as any.
How far away is Fertig?
60 miles. But he's moving.
What do you mean he's moving?
He figured maybe one of us would be captured. He didn't want us to tell the Japs if we got captured. If we don't know where he went, we can't tell the Japs.
Oh, Jesus. But no sweat, McCoy. He'll find us if the Japs don't find us first.
What do you think of Fertig?
He's a little weird, Everly said. He's got a little red goatee, and I guess you know he's not a real general. He was a light colonel, I think. But he's smart, and he's got balls.
That's about as close to high praise as Everly is likely to give, McCoy decided.
Okay, here's the drill. The first thing we do is get Koffler and one of the radios to Fertig. How do we do that?
I know where to meet Captain Hedges and the patrol. How many men on the patrol? Enough to carry this stuff?
Enough to carry a lot of it. You won't believe how much crap these flips can carry. But I don't know how many men. Probably 15, 20 anyhow.
Can a couple of them take Koffler to Fertig? I guess he's got about 100 pounds of gear.
I got a motorcycle stashed a ways back, Everly said. If I can find the son of a bitch.
Can we strap what he has to take on a motorcycle?
What about Japs on the road?
I don't know, Everly said. And the general didn't say anything, but like I said, he's smart. He'll probably do something the other side of Boston to have all the Japs running around up there.
Fertig, you mean?
Everly nodded.
Or I could carry... What'd you say his name was?
Koffler.
Koffler and his stuff to the motorcycle and wait until tonight to move down the road.
Your call, McCoy said. Just keep in mind, getting Koffler and that radio to Fertig is the most important thing right now.
Just one radio?
I got another one here, and there's two more on the sub if we can get more stuff off.
He looked out to sea. The first boat had reached Koffler and Weston, and Lewis was shoving black plastic-wrapped parcels over the side. Captain Robert B. Macklin, USMC, was kneeling in the center of the boat, doing, as far as McCoy could see, absolutely nothing. The second boat, carrying Zimmerman and two sailors from the Sunfish, was approaching them. The sun was fully up now. If a Japanese patrol boat appeared, or worse, an airplane, the Sunfish would be in trouble. McCoy scanned the horizon and then the skies with the binoculars. There was nothing. Zimmerman's boat passed Lewis's and kept coming.
If they don't go over the side now, it'll turn over in the surf, McCoy mused aloud.
A minute later, his prediction came true. The boat flipped over on its side, dumping the three men and the stack of plastic-wrapped parcels into the sea.
Come on, we better get those people some weapons, McCoy said, and led Everly to the boat they had dragged off the beach into the jungle.
He reached into the boat, pulled a plastic-wrapped parcel of carbines from it, and slit the plastic.
That's a knife you had in Shanghai, right? Everly said.
So what?
Just curious, is all, Everly said.
Let me show you how this works, McCoy said, picking up one of the carbines. The safety and the magazine release are here on the trigger assembly. You flip the little lever horizontal to take it off safety. You push the button and the magazine falls out.
He demonstrated.
15 shots. You shove it back in until it clicks. Then you work the action, he demonstrated again, and it's ready to go.
Pistol cartridges, huh? Everly said scornfully, taking the weapon.
Hot pistol cartridges. They'd blow up a pistol.
Will they kill anybody?
Yeah, McCoy said. If you hit him, and he's not 500 yards away.
You, know that? Everly asked dubiously.
I know that. They're not a real rifle, but they're a lot better than a pistol.
Most people can't shoot a pistol to save their ass, Everly said.
That's the whole idea, McCoy said.
You got ammo, I hope. We're fucking near out of ammo, ours and Japanese. We're making our own fucking bullets from curtain rods and loading the cases with powder from Jap rounds. I'm down to 13 rounds for this.
He shifted his Thompson on his shoulder.
There's ammo for these and a couple of 145 ACP and 30-06 rounds, if we can get it off the sub.
Grenades? We could really use some grenades.
Not in this shipment, McCoy said. Maybe the next.
Is there going to be another shipment? More submarines?
In 21 days. If we can keep ourselves from getting killed before then, McCoy said.
He slid open a second parcel containing 4 U.S. carbines, caliber 30 M1, slung 3 of them around his shoulder, and started back to the beach. Lieutenant Chambers D. Lewis, dragging 2 plastic-wrapped parcels behind him, came out of the water.
Good morning, Mr. McCoy, he said. I see the Marines have landed, and the situation is presumably well in hand.
You weren't supposed to come ashore, McCoy said. I knew how important it was to you that Captain Macklin join your beach party, Lewis said, and I could not, I found, just go sailing away without proving to you that I could paddle a rubber boat as well as you.
McCoy looked over his shoulder. Macklin was moving as quickly as he could through chest-deep water toward the beach. So far as McCoy could see, he was not towing anything behind him. And then he laughed.
Oh, Christ, look at that.
Gunnery Sergeant Zimmerman, water streaming off his body, looking very distressed and annoyed, plodded heavily through the sand toward them, dragging four obviously heavy plastic-wrapped parcels. Behind him came the two sailors, each dragging two plastic-wrapped parcels.
"Why didn't you get out of the boat the way I told you?" McCoy asked.
"I couldn't see how deep the water was, and I didn't want to drown, for Christ's sake. I can't swim."
He recognized Everly.
"Hey, what do you say, Everly? How they hanging?"
"Can't complain. McCoy told me they made you a gunny."
"Yeah, how about that? You gonna lend a hand with this crap or just stand it with your thumb up your ass?"
"You may get stuck here," McCoy said to Lewis. "The place is liable to be crawling with Japs any time now. The Fertig guy, what's his name, Everly?"
"Weston, sir," Everly said. "Captain James Weston."
"He called me sir. I'll be damned," McCoy realized, surprised.
"Captain Weston took out a four-man Jap patrol as we were coming ashore. Everly thinks other Japs will come looking for them."
"That would be best," Everly said.
"Best," McCoy said. "What the hell are you talking about?"
"Worst is that they did hear Mr. Weston's Thompson and went off to tell somebody. Best would be if they didn't hear the gunfire but sent a couple of people looking for the first patrol. Better would be we could find the truck they're in."
"We don't know there's a truck," McCoy interrupted.
"And take that out. Hide the truck and the bodies in the bush someplace where they won't be found for a couple of days. That would make it less likely that the Japs could find the stuff we're going to stash here."
"Or find the truck and take it 5 miles, 10 miles from here," McCoy said thoughtfully.
"Even better," Everly agreed.
"What's wrong with your ankle?" McCoy asked.
"I fell out of a tree and sprained it," Everly said.
"Then how are we going to find the truck?"
"I could get a tree limb and make a crutch or something."
"You tell me where you think this truck is, Everly,
and I'll find the fucker," Gunny Zimmerman said matter-of-factly.
"You're going to have to go with them, Everly," McCoy said. "There's no way around it. We'll get the stuff into the jungle and wait here for you."
"Zimmerman, are those little rifles any good?" Everly asked.
"For what we're going to use them for," Zimmerman said.
"Well, you better give me one, then. All I have is 13 rounds for the Thompson. Unless... where's that 45 ammo, McCoy?"
"I don't know where it is right now."
"Then hand me one of them little rifles. We don't have much time."
"There is, of course," McCoy said, looking at Lewis, "one other option."
"You want me to go with them?"
"Why not?" "That's not what I meant," McCoy said, and then, pointing out the sea, went on. "Captain Weston is almost at the Sunfish. I could radio them to get the hell out of here the second he's aboard, and maybe that's what I should do. The U.S. Navy has gone to considerable expense and effort, Mr. McCoy, to place that vessel where she lies," Lewis said. "I don't think anyone aboard would want to leave until they unload the cargo or a Jap destroyer appears."
McCoy looked at him thoughtfully.
"Whichever comes first," Lewis added.
"You really are liable to get stuck here with us," McCoy said. "You understand that?"
"I had that unpleasant thought shortly after I got in the rubber boat," Lewis said. "Shall I pass the Sunfish the word to start unloading cargo?"
"The radio's right inside the bushes over there," McCoy said, pointing. Captain Robert B. Macklin waded the final steps ashore and then threw himself flat on the sand as if exhausted.
"He hurt or what?" Everly asked, concerned.
"Fuck him, let him lie there," McCoy said. "We have to get those boats back into the water," Lewis said, and then bellowed, "Macklin!"
in a surprisingly loud voice. Macklin raised his head to look at him, then moved his arms in a helpless gesture.
"Get your ass moving, Macklin! Start helping us get the boats back to the surf, or I'll shoot you myself!"
Lieutenant Lewis called. Captain Macklin continued to make gestures implying helpless exhaustion until Lieutenant Lewis took one of the carbines from Lieutenant McCoy, chambered around, and put the weapon to his shoulder. Then, his strength having miraculously returned, Captain Macklin scurried down the beach, grabbed the line on a rubber boat, and started to drag the boat toward the water. Lieutenant Everly's eyes grew wide, but he said nothing.
Were you really going to shoot him? McCoy asked, a smile on his face.
I don't know, Lewis said wonderingly.
Fortunately for both of us, neither did he. He then had a second thought.
Why don't we just let him paddle out to the sunfish and go aboard?
He stays, McCoy said firmly. Lewis nodded, turned away, and trotted toward the radio.
Who's he, McCoy?
Everly asked.
He's a dog robber for an admiral at Pearl Harbor. I met the asshole on the beach.
It's a long story, Everly. I'll tell you later, he said. 4. United States Submarine Sunfish, 126 degrees 48 minutes east longitude, 7 degrees 35 minutes west latitude, Philippine Sea, 0527 hours, 24 December, 1942.
The skipper?
Lieutenant Amos P. Youngman, USN, asked, leaving the second part of the interrogatory. Do you see that? Unsaid.
I see it,
Lieutenant Commander Warren T. Hauser, USN, replied. Both Commander Hauser and Lieutenant Youngman were on the crowded conning tower bridge of the Sunfish, binoculars to their eyes, alternately watching the rubber boats close to shore and scanning the skies and horizon for signs of Japanese activity. A passenger in the first rubber boat was returning to the Sunfish from the beach, a passenger wearing an old-fashioned, broad-brimmed campaign hat, what looked like dirty white pajamas, and a full blonde beard.
McCoy said he would try to send a senior officer out, Commander Hauser said. That must be him.
Lieutenant Youngman turned to the chief of the boat, who was scanning the horizon through binoculars.
Chief, make sure we bring that man safely aboard, he ordered.
Aye, aye, sir,
Chief Buchanan said. Chief Bosun's mate Buchanan turned, trained his binoculars toward shore, looked a moment, and then handed the binoculars to a sailor standing in the center of the people crowding the bridge. Then, moving with surprising agility for someone of his bulk, he disappeared down the hatch in the deck of the conning tower, and a moment later emerged on the deck of the submarine. By the time the rubber boat reached the Sunfish, Chief Buchanan had tied a half-inch line securely around his waist and placed the end into the hands of three sailors on the deck. He also made a loop in a second length of half-inch line, handed the end to the sailors, and was swinging the looped end in his hand, not unlike a cowboy about to lasso a calf for branding.
"Put the line around that gentleman!"
he bellowed as he made his way down the slippery, curved hull of the Sunfish. He tossed the line to the two sailors in the rubber boat. Their attempt to grab it failed, and Chief Buchanan, using language not customarily heard in Sunday schools, offered an unkind opinion vis-à-vis the legitimacy of their berths. He retrieved the line and tossed it again. This time the sailor in the aft of the rubber boat managed to snag it.
"Just put that over your head, sir," he called encouragingly, "and under your arms, and we'll have you aboard in no time."
Captain James B. Weston did as ordered, then lifted himself very unsteadily to his feet and jumped onto the curved hull. He lost his footing, fell flat on his face, and started to slide down the hull into the water.
"Haul away!"
Chief Buchanan bellowed. Captain Weston's descent became an ascent. He was dragged up the hull to the deck, where Chief Buchanan and one of the sailors jerked him to his feet.
"Right this way, sir, if you please," Chief Buchanan said.
From some long, dormant corner of Weston's memory, naval protocol suddenly came to life and could not be denied. He shrugged free of Chief Buchanan's arm, faced aft, and saluted.
"Permission to come aboard, sir?"
Chief Buchanan tried to place his hand on Weston's arm to guide him to the port in the conning tower. Weston, his right arm and hand still raised in salute, pushed him away with his left.
"Permission granted,"
a voice called. Weston followed the sound of the voice and saw a naval officer's face high on the conning tower. His salute was returned. Weston lowered his arm.
"Escort the gentleman to the wardroom," Commander Hauser ordered.
"Aye, aye, sir."
Weston allowed himself to be led down the deck and then through a hatch in the conning tower. He found himself in a hot, crowded world of dials and pipes, smelling of oil and sweat, with sailors in work clothing and officers in khaki staring at him with undisguised curiosity. He was led aft, and then Chief Buchanan pushed aside a green curtain and motioned him inside.
"Someone will be with you shortly, sir," Chief Buchanan said. "You'll have to excuse me. I've got to get back topside."
"Thank you,"
Weston said politely. He walked into the small compartment and turned around. The curtain was back in place and the chief gone. Weston sat down at the small table. On the chair beside him was a copy of the Saturday Evening Post. He picked it up. The curtain parted and a sailor stepped inside.
"A fresh coffee, sir?" he said. "If there's anything else, just push the button."
He set a tray before Weston. It held a cup and saucer, a silver coffee pot, a pitcher of something like cream, and a bowl of sugar cubes. A small plate held a half dozen chocolate chip cookies. Weston pushed at the cookies with his index finger, then picked one up and took a small bite.
"Are you hungry, sir?" the sailor asked. "Can I fix you something?"
Weston looked at him without replying.
Anything from an egg sandwich to steak and eggs, sir," the sailor said.
"Yes, please," Weston said.
"Which, sir, the sandwich or the steak and eggs?"
"Could I have both?"
"Absolutely," the sailor said, and left.
Weston took another bite of the chocolate chip cookie, and then thrust the whole thing in his mouth and chewed it very slowly. He poured coffee into the cup, then sniffed it, then took a sip. It was so hot it burned his lips. He added cream and a lump of sugar and stirred, then took another sip. He put another chocolate chip cookie in his mouth all at once, and then dipped a third into the coffee with cream and sugar. The curtain opened again as Weston mopped up the juice from the steak with a piece of toast. It was the officer who had given him permission to come aboard. Weston now saw the silver oak leaves of Lieutenant Commander on his collar points and started to rise, as officers of the Naval Service do in the presence of a superior officer.
"Keep your seat," the Lieutenant Commander said. "Cookie take care of you all right? Is there anything else we can get you?"
Weston shook his head no and then said,
"Thank you."
"I'm Warren Hauser. I'm the skipper."
"Captain Weston, sir," Weston said. "No, Lieutenant Weston, sir."
"Which is it, Mr. Weston?" Hauser said gently, smiling, offering his hand.
"Captain, U.S. Forces in the Philippines, sir. First Lieutenant, USMC."
"Welcome aboard the Sunfish, Captain."
"Thank you, sir. What's happening now, sir?"
"We're discharging cargo."
"Captain, if the Japs don't know you're here, they will shortly. A Jap patrol was on the beach just before the first rubber boat landed. I killed them, but someone's going to wonder where they are and probably right about now."
"Hell, we've come a long way with this stuff, and we'd like to discharge it. I understand you've had a supply problem."
"We haven't had any supplies at all," Weston said simply.
"So we heard," Captain Hauser said, and then changed the subject.
"As soon as we're finished here, we're going to Espiritu Santo."
"Where, sir?"
"It's an island, sort of a forward base. From there, I expect you'll be flown to Australia."
"Yes, sir."
"If you don't want anything else to eat, may I suggest a shower and a shave? And we'll find some khakis for you. I want to get back to the bridge, so if you will excuse me, we'll continue our conversation once we're underway. My officers are pretty damn curious."
"I think I'll keep the beard," Weston said. "Lieutenant McCoy said I wasn't to shave it off until General Pickering saw it.
From what I've seen of him, it would behoove you to do what Lieutenant McCoy told you."
"May I have another cup of coffee? I seem to have drunk all—"
"You can have anything on the Sunfish, Captain Weston," Lieutenant Commander Hauser said, and rang for the messman.
5. Approximately 30 miles south of Boston, Davao Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 0745 hours, 24 December, 1942. Lieutenant Chambers D. Lewis, USN, and First Lieutenant Kenneth R. McCoy, USMCR, were standing just inside the vegetation on the shore. McCoy was holding a carbine, the butt resting on his hip. Lewis had a carbine slung from his shoulder. The Sunfish lay about 200 yards offshore, her 4.2 cannon and anti-aircraft machine guns manned, her colors now hanging limply from the conning tower mast. She had surfaced just over 2 hours before. After McCoy made the decision, feeling the weight of it lying heavily on his shoulders, to take the chance that Everly and Zimmerman could find the Japanese truck, if in fact there was a truck, and get rid of it, there was hectic activity.
Four additional rubber boats were inflated and launched and manned by sailors. There was no shortage of volunteers from among the Sunfish's crew. They began to ferry plastic-wrapped parcels ashore. After the first two boats were manhandled back into the water, the surf had diminished since daybreak, they were paddled back to the submarine. The next four boats from the Sunfish didn't reach the beach. Their plastic-wrapped parcels were put over the side, and one of the two paddlers went into the water with them. The remaining paddlers paddled the now empty boats back to the Sunfish. That process was repeated four times, so that eventually 10 sailors were on the beach or else standing in waist-high water unloading the boats and moving the cargo inland. It was a far more efficient means to offload the cargo than they'd been using, but it had not occurred to anyone during the practice sessions in Australia. The idea was Lieutenant Lewis's. After he proposed it, McCoy went along with it, somewhat cold-bloodedly deciding that if the Japanese came submarine hunting with a destroyer, it really wouldn't make a difference whether the Sunfish sailors died aboard the submarine or ferrying cargo ashore. He had not really expected they would offload all the supplies they had brought with them, and now that there was a chance to do that, risking the sailors' lives seemed justifiable. After they started unloading, one of the sailors, a chubby cook, politely suggested to McCoy that he just let the Navy unload the boats and save his strength. McCoy accepted the offer, wondering whether he agreed to do that because it was the militarily wise thing, or because he would rather have someone else work up a major sweat in the heat and humidity. He also ordered Koffler to get into the shade and save his strength. As soon as Everly returned, if Everly returned, Koffler was going to have to look for Everly's motorcycle and then start out to find Fertig. He would need all his strength for that. How to get everything to Fertig, wherever Fertig was going to be a problem, but that could be worried about later. The important thing now was to move the supplies off the beach and into the jungle, where the Japanese would be unlikely to find them. 40 minutes later, Everly came out of the jungle, hopping with surprising speed with the aid of a tree branch used as a crutch. He had both the carbine and an Arisaka rifle slung over his shoulder.
"Found it," he said. "We lucked out. All there was a sergeant and the driver. Zimmerman cut their throats."
"Where is he?"
"He took the truck south."
"How's he going to get back here?"
"He's only going to take it 2 miles," he said. "He said that's far enough. Then he's coming back here."
"What's this?" McCoy asked, tapping the stock of the Arisaka.
"A souvenir?"
"Until you showed up, McCoy, we got our weapons from the Japs."
"Okay. The thing to do now is get Koffler and his radio to Fertig. Can you find your motorcycle?"
"Yeah."
"Koffler!"
McCoy called, raising his voice, and Koffler came running up. The sweat had erased much of the black whatever it was that he had had on his face when Everly first saw him. Now he looked even younger.
"Go with Everly, Steve. You know what to do," McCoy said.
"Aye, aye, sir."
Having completed their final trip to the beach, two of the rubber boats were almost back to the Sunfish, carrying with them members of the shore labor party. Before wading a final time into the surf, each of them had shaken hands with the landing party. The third boat was halfway between shore and the submarine. The fourth had two sailors in it. A third sailor in chest-deep water was holding it for Lewis to wade out to it. Using leafy branches from the jungle as a broom, Captain Macklin was doing what he could to obliterate the evidence of heavy traffic in the sand.
"You didn't have to come ashore," McCoy said, offering Lewis his hand.
"I appreciate it. Take care of yourself, Lewis."
"Let me take him back with me, Ken," Lewis said, nodding at Macklin.
"No," McCoy said firmly.
"He's going to cause trouble," Lewis argued.
"Two things. General Pickering wants him here," McCoy said, "and I realized, so do I."
"Why, for God's sake?"
"I guess the idea of the son of a bitch standing around some old club bar making it big time with some nurse with stories of being in the Philippines with the gorillas just pisses me off," McCoy said wryly, and then grew serious. "He's a Marine officer. He was sent here, goddammit, and he should behave like a Marine officer. If he can't hack it, then he shouldn't be a Marine officer."
"If he threatens your mission, would you really kill him?"
"I hope I don't have to," McCoy said. "But I'm not sending the son of a bitch back."
"I was afraid you'd say that," Lewis said.
McCoy shrugged. "If you can figure some way to do it without getting your ass in a crack,
get word through Ed Sessions to my girl that I'm all right, McCoy said.
Sorry, I can't do that, Lewis said.
He walked out of the vegetation to the edge of the water, cupped his hands to his mouth, and shouted,
Boats! Take that man aboard and get out to the Sunfish. I'm staying ashore.
Hey, wait a minute, McCoy called, running out to Lewis.
You heard me, boats! Shove off!
Lewis shouted. The two sailors in the rubber boat quickly hauled the one in the water into the boat and started paddling out to the Sunfish.
Are you out of your mind? McCoy asked.
Probably, Lewis said with a smile.
Two things. I don't want you shooting Macklin, and I really don't want to go back aboard that goddamn submarine.
If I decide I have to take care of him, you're not going to get in my way, McCoy said.
Understood, Lewis said.
They moved back into the vegetation and watched as the boat reached the Sunfish and as it and the crew were quickly hauled aboard.
You could still get on the radio and tell them to come get you.
Too late, Lewis said and pointed. The colors were suddenly gone from the mast and her decks were clear. She began to move very slowly and very slowly to slip beneath the surface.
I hope you remembered to bring something to eat, Lewis said.
Just for the record, I think you've lost your mind, McCoy said. We've got some army rations, sea rations, they call them.
6. Headquarters, U.S. Forces in the Philippines, in the field, Davao Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines. 0705 hours, 25 December, 1942. The commanding general had left instructions that he was not to be awakened. Unless, of course, there was an indication the Japanese were nearby. So the first view Staff Sergeant Stephen Koffler, USMCR, had of Brigadier General Wendell W. Fertig was of a middle-aged man with a red goatee rising from his bed. The bed was a piece of canvas laid on the ground beneath an obviously freshly and hastily constructed lean-to. This apparition was wearing a frayed and mussed khaki shirt, to the collar points of which were pinned silver stars. Matching trousers and a pair of battered boots were hanging from the lean-to roof. The general held a model 1911 45 ACP pistol, hammer-cocked, and looked somewhat startled. The first view General Fertig had of Staff Sergeant Koffler was of a boy, an American boy who looked about 17, in dyed black khakis. His arms and the backs of his hands were black, and his white face was framed in more black, under his hairline and down his neck. In his hand, he was carrying a very small rifle, of a type Fertig had never seen before, and something like a cut-off sword was hanging from his neck on a cord. The boy came to attention and saluted.
Staff Sergeant Koffler, U.S. Marine Corps reporting, sir.
General Fertig returned the salute.
Reporting from where, Sergeant?
Fertig asked as he reached up and took his trousers from the lean-to wall. The boy took some time to consider the question. It seemed to confuse him for a moment.
From Australia, sir. General Pickering sent us. Thank God. And who is General Pickering?
That question also seemed to momentarily confuse him.
He's a Marine general, sir. We worked for him. You landed by submarine? Fertig asked as he pushed his legs into his still soggy trousers. Yes, sir. We came off the Sunfish. And how many of you are there? Three of us, sir, plus an officer from the OSS.
What the hell is the OSS?
And the name of your commanding officer? McCoy, sir. Lieutenant McCoy. They sent a lieutenant? Well, that certainly establishes our position, doesn't it? And where is Lieutenant McCoy?
I left him on the beach with the supplies, sir. Lieutenant Everly rode me on his motorcycle to where we met Captain Hedges. Captain Hedges sent this guy,
he pointed to a Filipino standing to one side,
to bring me on the motorcycle to you, and then he took the patrol back to the beach.
What sort of supplies, Sergeant?
Some weapons, sir, some medicine, other stuff, and the gold, too, of course.
Gold? Fertig asked as he pulled on his boots.
Yes, sir,
Koffler said, and pulled his dyed black khaki shirt out of his trousers. Around his waist were two dully gleaming black belts. One formed a tube about 2 inches wide. The second was narrower with a package about 5 inches square in the center. Koffler untied the cords that closed the tubular belt and handed it to Fertig. It was a good deal heavier than it looked.
God, is there really gold in here?
Fertig felt what could be coins under the strange, smooth, slippery material. He tried to find an opening.
If you want to open that, sir, Koffler said helpfully, you're going to have to cut it. That plastic can't be torn.
Fertig looked at him. Koffler ducked out of the cord around his neck and handed Fertig the sword.
What is plastic, Sergeant?
He asked, taking the sword and testing the blade with his thumb. It was as sharp as a razor.
I don't really know what it is, sir, Koffler said. The army started packing the radios in it, and we used it to pack the stuff we brought you.
Fertig slit the plastic. A gleaming United States $20 gold piece fell out.
We're each wearing a money belt, General, Koffler said. And there are a couple of bundles back on the beach. There's $250,000 in all.
If they're sending me that kind of money, somebody is taking us seriously. And you were sent here to deliver the gold?
No, sir. I was sent here to find you, and when I did, to call Australia.
We have a radio, but at the moment it's not working. We're on the move, as you can see.
I've got a radio, General, Koffler said. I've got 2 hours' worth of batteries, so if you've got a generator, that would be helpful. But all I really need is some help to string my antenna. I can be on the air in a couple of minutes.
You're a radio operator, Sergeant?
Yes, sir. That's why General Pickering sent me.
Fertig looked at the Filipino.
Ask Lieutenant Ball and Sergeant Lamadrid to report to me, would you please? He said.
He turned back to Koffler.
Lieutenant Ball is my signal officer, he said. They'll string your antenna for you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
This is interesting, Fertig said, fingering the sword.
What is it? Lieutenant McCoy told me that when the war just started, some army asshole...
He stopped, horrified at what he had just said.
It's all right, Sergeant. I am perfectly willing to agree that there are a number of assholes in the United States Army.
Some army guys sent 20,000 of them to Australia. They're cavalry sabers. An ordnance officer, an army ordnance officer, cut them down and sharpened them. They make pretty good machetes, good steel in them.
I see. And that weapon of yours?
Koffler handed it to him.
It's what they call a carbine, General. Sort of halfway between a pistol and a rifle. 15 shots, they're good out to about 100 yards. We brought you 100 of them, if they got them all off the submarine. They were going to try to unload some more stuff, maybe all we brought if the Japs didn't show up.
Interesting weapon, Fertig said, turning it over in his hands.
Colonel Stecker and McCoy decided it would be smarter to bring carbines than rifles. They're smaller, the ammo doesn't weigh as much, and the colonel thought that your Filipinos could probably handle them better than rifles.
Colonel Stecker. Who is he, Sergeant?
Marine Colonel, sir. He won the Medal of Honor in the First World War. He was supposed to come in with us, but they're going to make him a general and send him to Washington, so he couldn't.
So at least 2 people more senior than a lieutenant are involved in this. Thank God.
And then another question occurred to him.
Did you meet Captain Weston?
Yes, sir.
Presumably he is with your Lieutenant McCoy, I believe you said. On the beach?
Yes, sir. Lieutenant McCoy. No, sir. Mr. McCoy sent him to Australia on the submarine.
He did what?
Fertig asked, at first greatly surprised and then suddenly annoyed.
On whose authority? He wondered angrily, aloud.
Mr. McCoy sent him to Australia, sir, Koffler said. I guess he figured he had the authority to do that, otherwise he wouldn't have done it.
I can't wait to meet Lieutenant McCoy, Fertig said.
Lieutenant Robert Ball appeared, sleepy-eyed. He looked at Koffler with undisguised curiosity.
You sent for me, General?
This is Staff Sergeant Koffler of the United States Marines, Fertig said. He needs some assistance to erect an antenna. He intends to communicate with Australia with it. Would you and Sergeant Lamadrid assist him, please?
Yes, sir, Ball said.
He offered his hand to Koffler.
I hope you've got some wire.
Yes, sir. I've cut a straight wire for the 20-meter band, insulators and everything. It's in one of the parcels.
And you have a radio?
A radio, a key, and enough batteries for 2 hours.
Have you got a generator?
It'll take an hour to get it running. It's in pieces.
Then I guess we better go with the batteries for now, Koffler said.
It won't take long, but I am going to need a generator pretty soon.
With Lieutenant Ball and Sergeant Lamadrid, and halfway through the process, General Fertig, as a fascinated audience, Sergeant Koffler carefully removed the plastic coating from several packages. There were four identical packages, each containing a battery. Others held a neatly coiled roll of copper wire, to which were attached ceramic insulator, a receiver, a transmitter, a high-speed telegraphic key, and a small set of headphones. The receiving and transmitting antennae were quickly erected. Koffler pulled his shirt from his trousers again and untied the second plastic belt. With all the care of a surgeon, he used his machete to slit open the square package.
"Gotta be careful as hell with this," he explained. "Not only is it printed on what looks like toilet paper, but it's soaked in some chemical that makes it practically explode if you get a match near it."
Inside the package was an oilskin envelope. Koffler opened it, removed a pad of paper, tore the first sheet from it, and carefully tucked it in his pocket. Then he put the pad of paper back in the oilskin envelope, carefully closed it, and looked at Lieutenant Ball.
"This is your new SOI," he said. "You got some place to keep it where it won't get fucked up, or would you rather I keep it?"
"I'll keep it safe," Ball said, and Koffler handed it to him.
"Lieutenant McCoy's got another copy," he said. "But if we lose both, we're all back up Schitt's Creek."
He took the flimsy sheet of paper from his pocket and read it carefully. Taking note of the interest of his audience, he then handed it to General Fertig.
"I thought it was K and P, but it always pays to check," Koffler said.
"Message 001, Part A, to be transmitted in the clear, repeated twice. Operational immediate, from MXX for immediate personal attention sync pack. All stations copied for relay to KFS. Part B. One or more of the following as appropriate to be transmitted in the clear, repeated four times. AAA. Landing party aborting mission attempting return Sunfish. BBB. Landing party ashore lost contact with Sunfish. CCC. Sunfish detected by enemy ashore. DDD. Sunfish detected by enemy surface craft. EEE. Sunfish detected by enemy aircraft. FFF. Sunfish under attack by enemy artillery. GGG. Sunfish under attack by enemy surface craft. HHH. Sunfish under attack by enemy aircraft. III. Sunfish believed damaged. JJJ. Sunfish believed sunk by enemy action. KKK. Sunfish safely departed undamaged. LLL. Landing party ashore. Suspect detection moving inland. MMM. Landing party detected situation in doubt. NNN. Landing party safely ashore. No contact with friendlies. OOO. Landing party safely ashore in contact with friendlies. PPP. Landing party safely ashore in contact with Fertig. Part C. To be transmitted in the clear repeated twice. End. MXX clear.
K and P does have a nice ring to it, doesn't it, Sergeant? General Fertig said.
Yes, sir, it does, Sergeant Koffler said. Put a match to that, General. We don't need it anymore.
Fertig shrugged, took out his lighter, and applied the flame to the small sheet of paper. There was a flash, a small cloud of smoke, and the paper disappeared.
I'll be damned, the commanding general, USFIP, said. Now, let's see if we can get this son of a bitch on the air, Sergeant Koffler said, and put the earphones on his head.
7. Rocky Fields Farm, Bernardsville, New Jersey, 23:15 hours, 25 December, 1942. When the telephone rang, Miss Ernestine Sage had been standing for 10 minutes in her bathrobe before the fireplace in the living room, leaning on the mantelpiece, toying with a poker at the vestiges of the fire that had blazed all day. She and her parents had gone to bed over an hour before. In a transparent effort to cheer her up, her father had kept the house filled with friends on Christmas Eve and with a dinner for 12 on Christmas Day. "It's been a long day for everybody," her father had announced, "and getting to bed early won't do anyone any harm." Unable to sleep, she tossed around for a long time, then left the bed, wrapped herself in a bathrobe, and went downstairs. There she'd fixed herself a stiff drink and swallowed deep, then set the glass on the mantelpiece of the fireplace. She walked quickly to the telephone, feeling sick.
"That has to be bad news. Why the hell else would anyone call at this hour on Christmas?"
"Ernie?"
She recognized the voice of Captain Ed Sessions.
"Oh, no."
"Oh, no, what?"
"Oh, no, what the hell do you think? Tell me, Ed. Oh, Christ, don't tell me. I don't want this goddamn call."
Ken's been heard from,
Sessions said.
And?
He reached where he was going safely. They all did. An operational immediate to Knox. Info us. Came in just a few minutes ago from Sinkback. I'm the duty officer here. I got it.
There was no reply.
I thought you'd like to know.
I'd like to know that you're surprised he got safely where he's supposed to go. Exactly where he got safely to, being another of your goddamn secrets, and from which you'll be surprised again if he makes it safely out. Captain Ed Sessions, who could think of nothing to say, said nothing.
Ed, I'm sorry. I had a premonition all day.
Ken can take care of himself. He'll be all right,
he said, comforting the near-hysterical female, and knowing goddamn well he didn't know any more than she did whether or not he'd be all right.
If I didn't mean that, I wouldn't say it. And you don't sound hysterical.
The only reason I'm not screaming and pulling out my hair is that it would embarrass my parents, Ernie said. My father's big on bad form.
Ernie, Ken's going to be all right.
So, how's the baby?
She said, to change the subject.
Baby's fine. Come down and have a look for yourself.
I can't do that. I get overwhelmed with jealousy. Ken wouldn't give me one in case you didn't notice.
Control your jealousy and come down. Jean would love to have you.
There was a long pause. Ed, I'm sorry. I've been a bitch. I very much appreciate the call, and I have no right to jump all over you.
You can get a little excited, Ernie, but you'll never be a bitch.
Have you got a number for Pick? She asked.
He's living in the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, isn't he?
I tried there before. No answer.
I've got his squadron number here someplace. Hold one.
She heard the phone being laid down, and then he came back on the line and gave her a number.
Maybe they can help.
She heard another telephone ringing, so she knew he was not trying to get rid of her when he said,
Ernie, I have to go.
Good night, Ed. Merry Christmas. Thank you. Happy New Year.
Why don't you come down for New Year's? Think about it,
he said, and then the line went dead.
Newton 46761, Newton 46761,
she repeated over and over until she searched for and found a pencil and could write it down. Then she dialed the operator and said,
A long distance, please. In Memphis, Tennessee, Newton 46761.
Is this call necessary?
The operator asked, in compliance with the government policy to lower the incidence of long-distance calls in order to keep lines free for essential war-connected business.
No, I'm a Nazi spy trying to tie up the line so that we'll lose the war, Ernie said.
Is this call necessary?
The operator repeated.
Yes, it is.
The phone was answered on the second ring.
BMF 262, Sergeant Cabin in charge of quarters speaking, sir.
I'm trying to locate Lieutenant Pickering.
Hold one, ma'am,
Sergeant Cadman said, and she heard the phone being laid down, and then, faintly,
For you, sir, a lady.
Lieutenant Pickering.
Relax. You don't have to marry me, at least right now.
Well, God, that's a relief. I'm much too young for that sort of responsibility. What's up?
What are you doing in, what is that, your office? At this time of night?
Well, before I was summoned to the telephone, I was trying to sleep. I've got the duty.
You can sleep on duty?
There's a cot. What's up, Ernie?
Ed Sessions just called. Ken got wherever he went, safely. Just where that is being another goddamn secret.
If they won't tell you where he is, he's probably in the Philippines,
Pickering said.
The Philippines? My God, the Japanese have captured the Philippines!
On reflection, I don't think I should have said what I just said.
Well, you can't leave me hanging, damn you.
If you insist on swearing at me, I'll never marry you, Ernie.
Damn you, Pick!
I really don't know what I'm talking about, but Dad wrote Mom, and she told me, that he was trying to help some gorillas in the Philippines.
Gorillas? As in King Kong? What are you talking about?
Gorillas, with a U and an E. Irregular troops operating behind enemy lines. That sounds right down the killer's line.
Oh, my God.
Hey, Ernie, don't underestimate him. He's one hell of a Marine.
Oh, yeah, she said sarcastically.
Ernie, I'd love to chat, but this is an official line, and little Billy Dunn, my noble squadron commander, is celebrating the joyous Yuletide season by taking our guys up to teach them how to fly in the dark.
On Christmas Eve? Christmas Day night?
Some of them shouldn't be trusted with a tricycle, much less a Corsair. He may have to call.
Billy has people flying tonight? She asked incredulously.
Write this down, Ernie. There's a war on.
And I'm being hysterical, right?
You said it, not me. Ken will be all right, Ernie. And if he isn't, well, at least you get to marry me.
You son of a bitch, you! She flamed.
Now there's my girl back to normal. Nighty-night, Ernie.
The line went dead in her ear. She replaced the phone in its cradle. Everything all right, honey? Her father asked. He was standing behind one of the couches wearing his bathrobe. His usually slicked back hair was askew.
How long have you been in here?
I heard the phone, he said.
It was from an officer who works for Uncle Fleming. He told me that Ken is safely where he's going, but where that is a big secret. So I called Pick, and Pick says he's probably in the Philippines. Uncle Fleming wrote Aunt Patricia about helping guerrillas in the Philippines, and she told Pick, and Pick said that's probably where Ken is. That's right down the killer's line, is the way he put it.
Ken'll be all right, honey, Ernest Sage said gently.
If one more person says that to me, I'll throw up,
Ernie snapped. And then she ran into her father's arms and wept. Part 16 1. Headquarters, U.S. Forces in the Philippines, Davao Oriental Province, Mindanao, Commonwealth of the Philippines, 0625 hours, 28 December, 1942. The first thing General Fertig noticed about the three officers and a Marine sergeant who had come to see him was that they all looked so well nourished, and that their sturdy-looking black clothing and boots were in such good shape. The second thing he noticed as they approached his house was that the two officers wearing the double silver bars of captains stood aside at the foot of the stairs to permit the youngest and slightest and most junior, to judge from the single silver bar pinned to his soft cap, to climb up the ladder first.
That has to be Lieutenant Killer McCoy, who took it upon himself to order Captain Weston away on the submarine. That young man is about to be put in his place.
The lieutenant saluted as he walked across the porch to Fertig.
Lieutenant McCoy, sir, USMC, he said.
Fertig returned the salute.
And these gentlemen?
Lieutenant Lewis, sir, of SyncPAC, McCoy said. Captain Macklin of the OSS and Gunnery Sergeant Zimmerman.
I have an idea what the OSS is, but I am not going to ask. Welcome to U.S. Forces in the Philippines, gentlemen. My name is Fertig.
He shook hands with everybody and motioned for them to sit in the rattan chairs.
We're a little surprised to find you here, General, McCoy said. Everly said that you were on the run.
A precautionary measure, Fertig said, in case the Japanese captured one of my officers. When I learned that didn't happen, we came back home.
Yes, sir, McCoy said.
Just to clear the air, who is in command of this mission?
Lieutenant McCoy is, General, Lewis said. Captain Macklin and myself are observers.
I understand you took it upon yourself, Lieutenant, to order one of my officers aboard the submarine.
Yes, sir. Acting on orders, sir, McCoy said.
Ah, and what precisely are those orders, Lieutenant? Do I get to see a copy of them?
My orders were verbal, sir, from General Pickering. They were to find you, to provide you with communications equipment and a signal operating instruction, to bring you a few supplies, including some gold, to evaluate your potential.
You consider yourself qualified to evaluate my forces?
Fertig interrupted.
And to send one of your senior officers back on the Sunfish, McCoy went on.
Sir, it doesn't matter what I think of my qualifications. You're sort of stuck with me. Presumably you're on General MacArthur's staff?
McCoy smiled.
No, sir. I'm assigned to the USMC Office of Management Analysis, sir.
And you're here to analyze my management, is that what you're saying?
General, Lewis said, if I may.
Fertig nodded. Among those officers available to General Pickering, Lieutenant McCoy was determined to be the one most familiar with irregular operations. He's done this sort of thing before.
Conducted guerrilla operations, you mean?
Operated behind the enemy's lines, sir.
And who is General Pickering. He presumably is on General MacArthur's staff.
No, sir. He's chief of the Office of Management Analysis, McCoy said.
So you're not here representing General MacArthur and Sweepo?
No, sir, McCoy said.
General, Lewis said, I'm on the staff of SyncPAC. SyncPAC was directed by Admiral Leahy, the President's chief of staff, to provide whatever assistance General Pickering required to mount this mission.
And that assistance is 3 junior officers and a sergeant, apparently.
I had hoped that what we're trying to do here had finally attracted General MacArthur's interest and concern, Fertig said. Apparently that is not the case.
El Supremo went on record, General, McCoy said, saying guerrilla operations in the Philippines are impossible.
Is that what you call him, Lieutenant El Supremo?
I presume you are referring to General MacArthur.
And you made it worse when you promoted yourself, General, McCoy went on unabashed.
I considered that necessary, Fertig said. I didn't think anyone would pay attention to a lieutenant colonel.
I believe both General Pickering and Admiral Nimitz understand that, General, Lewis said.
I believe Lieutenant McCoy is trying, sir, to make you aware of certain problems we all have to deal with.
I am here with several hundred courageous men, American and Filipino, living on the edge of starvation, like hunted animals in the jungle, attempting to wage war against the Japanese, and I find myself a humble supplicant on my knees begging for the tools to do that, Fertig said. I confess that from time to time I find myself growing a little bitter.
May I suggest, sir, Lewis said, that first, what you have been doing here has not gone unappreciated, and second, that your supply situation has already begun to change? We've brought some supplies with us, at least a token shipment, and more will very likely follow.
Depending on a lieutenant's analysis of my management, is that what you're saying?
Sir, I have reason to believe, Lewis said, that whatever Lieutenant McCoy's report happens to be, it will be accepted at face value at the highest levels.
Is that so? What are your reasons for believing that?
Sir, Lewis said, I don't think you have been in a position to know that early on the President ordered the formation of a special unit within the Marine Corps, the Marine Raiders, something like the British Commandos, with the mission of attacking the Japanese in an irregular manner. In August, 10 days after the 1st Marine Division landed at Guadalcanal, elements of the 2nd Raider Battalion, operating off a submarine, successfully attacked McKean Island.
Very interesting, Fertig said. If they could send a submarine to, McKean Island in August, why couldn't they send one here?
Sir, with respect, Lewis said, the first indication anyone had that you had established a guerrilla operation here was in early October.
God damn it. I'm making a fool of myself. What the hell is the matter with me? Why am I being such a horse's ass to these people? Possibly because I am losing my mind. Or because, in some perverted manner, these well-fed, well-shod, self-confident, especially that damned Killer McCoy, young officers anger me.
As I was saying, sir, Lewis said, the Marine Raiders successfully attacked Japanese positions on McKean Island. Lieutenant McCoy and Sergeant Zimmerman were on that operation, General.
Lieutenant, please don't get the idea that my anger at the powers that be is in any way directed at you, Fertig said. I am overjoyed to see you here, and fully appreciative of the enormous risks you all took to come here.
I'm a Marine, General, McCoy said, visibly embarrassed. I go where they send me.
If I may continue, General, Lewis said, Captain James Roosevelt, USMC, the President's son, was also on the McKean Island raid. Captain Roosevelt is known to be another of Lieutenant McCoy's admirers.
I submit, sir, that whatever Lieutenant McCoy has to say about your operation here and its potential will receive a very sympathetic ear from the President.
I take your point, Fertig said. I hope to convince you, then, Lieutenant, that what we have here is potentially a very valuable force with which to wage war, and that we are not a motley crew of insubordinate lunatics headed by a self-promoted egomaniac.
I'm ready to be convinced, sir,
McCoy said with a smile.
You haven't said anything, Captain, Fertig said to Macklin. What's your role in this operation? Starting at the beginning, what is the OSS?